Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today I'm here with Rebecca Schofield, who is an associate professor of history at the University of Idaho. And today we're going to talk about her 2019 book, Outriders, Rodeo at the Fringes of the American West, that was just published by the University of Washington Press. Rebecca, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Would you start by just sort of explaining your book to our listeners?
Yeah, so Outriders began sort of as a look at my own relationship with the West. I was raised in Idaho, could not wait to get out. I did a lot of my undergraduate studies and my master's degree on Japanese cultural history. And actually, while I was in Tokyo doing some research on the acrylic nail industry, when I was in my master's degree, so this is probably 2009, I ran across a store in Tokyo called Rodeo Clowns, selling tiny jean shorts and flannel shirts to Japanese schoolgirls. And that really started me thinking about the performance of the West and how the sort of Western identity emerged and continues to haunt people across the globe. And so I began to look at how and where are those spaces where people can kind of perform being a cowboy, whether that's Western wear or mechanical bull riding or music. And I found rodeo to be one of those spaces that, having grown up around rodeo, made total sense to me. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. But while I was doing my graduate degrees on the East Coast, and I could take a step back and look at this arena, it was a very fascinating cultural performance. So I began looking at spaces in which we might not expect rodeo to happen. And I sort of followed those threads into four different stories about groups of people who may have actually had the cowboy weaponized against them, but they used their rodeo performances to state claims of belonging in American culture.
Well, so before we go into each of those stories, and we should spend some time on all of them, you know, I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about the meaning of rodeo in the West. I mean, you know, you grew up in the rural West. You know, I grew up in the, you know, kind of on the fringes of the rural West, including, you know, my dad's from Lewiston, so I know the Idaho world pretty well. And so, you know, it's not as if I was going to rodeos on a daily basis or anything, but it was certainly something that was around. I've been to rodeos. And you know, it's, again, it kind of seems normal if you're out there, but then you go to the rest of the country and it sort of isn't. So, you know, what is the sort of the appeal of the rodeo, or maybe another way of asking this or a different question is the meaning, what should we take out of the existence of the rodeo as, you know, people who maybe aren't really in that world?
Yeah, I mean, I think its persistence as a sport is pretty incredible, right? Particularly if you do rodeo history, the most common theme is that rodeo is about to die from the 1920s onward. It's the belief, like, any moment now, we're not going to have a generation of people who want to rodeo. And so, you know, rodeo sort of grew out of, you know, having grown up in the rural West, like, you want to get on things and you want to ride things, even if that might be a little bit crazy. So it started as roundups and kind of the ways in which people wanted to capture cowboy play and roping and riding. And then as we get into the 1920s and the really sort of exhibitionist, you know, the sporting events that are happening at Madison Square Garden, you have things like the introduction of bull riding. And what we really see is this kind of shift in the 20th century from rodeo cowboys being seen as kind of fake cowboys, just out there playing and risking bodily injury, versus a real cowboy who would have been working on a ranch. And of course, it's also noteworthy to distinguish between cattlemen who were landed and sort of upheld those kind of staid patriarchal values of supporting your family, and then cowboys who were really seen as nomadic. They lived in homosocial settings and were really seen as working class ruffians until the kind of cultural iconization of them in the early 20th century. And so it's interesting over the 20th century that you have so many people willing to really put their bodies on the line. And that's one of the things I really focus on in the book, is that we can look at the consumption of cowboy identities in lots of different places, you know, film, fashion. Rodeo is the place where people actually die to prove that they're a cowboy. And the fact that you have kids entering the sport today who didn't grow up on ranches, who didn't have this sort of rural background, but are still willing to die in order to prove they're a cowboy, which I think is very important in why this is a crucial space to study. It's that kind of twinning between theater and violence.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess as a follow-up, you know, one thing that you know, that I'm very interested in is the Western, and you know, this as a film genre, and the ways in which, you know, this cowboy culture remains pretty powerful in America, to the point that as you're pointing out, people are you know, young people are going into the rodeo even though they don't have even any background on ranches, and yet, you know, sort of other parts of Western iconography are not as powerful as they used to be, right? There's very few Western films, for instance, or television shows or things like that. I mean, why do you think that the rodeo has remained, especially because, like, it is so dangerous, or maybe it is because it's so dangerous, why do you think it's remained such a salient part of American culture?
Yeah, I think part of it is because it is so dangerous, and because it's been invested in as a sporting event, so you can make money doing that. And I think that we see the ebbs and flows in things like Western film or Western fashion or Western music. And, you know, there are sort of dips in its popularity over time. Usually we see it reascend in a new way, but... you know, that popularity, I believe, will come back for Western films, maybe in a new formulation. But with rodeo, there's this pretty steady interest in it, because it goes from being something, yeah, you can make a couple bucks at, maybe you can tour the world with a company, to a massive industry that is televised and you can make lots of money at. And so then you have the development of these rodeo schools that start kids very young to sort of train them up, so that by the time they're in their 20s, they're pulling in hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, that's going to be a very short career, as most, you know, contact sports have a pretty short career. But they can really make some money at it. And I think that part of that investment was really in the 60s, 70s, 80s, during that kind of cowboy chic moment, that money started to get funneled into it as a sport, and that has maintained it. And we have the creation, of course, of niche circuits like the Professional Bull Riders Association, where you can go to a PBR and just watch bulls. And so you have the ways in which it is an industry, and they have very successfully navigated those aspects to keep the audience sort of coming in. And I think it's a place where people can go to kind of catch a glimpse of an idealized Americana. It's a great sort of tourist thing for places, you know, places in Colorado or near Yellowstone can draw in people to see a weekend rodeo. And it's maintained that kind of cultural cachet in the West.
So, you know, we could talk about the generalities of rodeo forever, or at least I could. But, you know, your book does something a lot more interesting, right? Which, you know, again, the post-colon title is Rodeo at the Fringes of the West. And, you know, you have four sections, and each looks at a different group that one would not think of as central to the rodeo world. And I think maybe it makes some sense to go through each one. So would you start, you know, with your first chapter that talks about women in the rodeo?
Yeah. So there's actually been a lot of really amazing scholarship on cowgirls and early cowgirls, because, you know, we have this perception today that, you know, it's just a girl and her horse and she barrel races, and that's the only thing women have ever done. And that's simply not true. In the early 20th century, there was a pretty large contingent of cowgirls who bronc rode, who did bull riding exhibitions. Some did bulldogging exhibitions, trick riding. And what I try to do in my section is really look at this through the lens of a particular woman who was an immigrant, and how she sort of used rodeo as a way to make claims to Americanness and to assimilation, essentially. So Matilda Winger first immigrated to the United States and to New York, and she worked as a hairdresser in New York City. And she sort of narrates the story of seeing trick riders out on Staten Island, which of course at the time was very rural. And she just sort of runs away with the rodeo, which was very similar, you know, to a lot of emerging entertainment at the time, right? We have vaudeville, we have circus performers, we have people who are kind of finding these forms of entertainment as a way to travel the world and find new economic opportunities for themselves. So a lot of the women who were, you know, working as cowgirls did this. However, they walked a very tight line between sort of the propriety that was still expected of them. So a lot of the women who ran away with the circus or who performed in vaudeville, they were not going to be considered respectable at the time. And what cowgirls were able to do was sort of draw on this anti-modernist rhetoric that was very popular at the time to say, we are simply real American women. We are the rugged daughters of a rugged West. And Matilda Winger, who changes her name to Tilly Baldwin and travels and is very successful as a bronc rider. And she's able to do that somewhat because she travels with a male partner who people often assume is her brother or her husband, which gives her kind of that protection on the rodeo road. There's really amazing stories of these women and the, you know, what they're able to do in a time when you have suffrage debates and you have a lot of angst in the United States about the role of immigrants, about the role of women, about the role of the United States in the world. And the way in which she's navigating these debates, all sort of grounded in her ability to ride. And unlike a lot of women who simply, you know, passed as native born white women, Matilda Winger would often sort of trot out her immigrant story to say, I'm actually even more American because I went West. I am not just the daughter of a pioneer who was raised on a ranch. I went West myself. I sort of claimed this identity while also at the same time kind of pushing back on what it means to be a cowgirl. And she eventually, you know, after her rodeo career dies, as it so often did with marriage, she marries someone, she moves back to Connecticut, but her town in Connecticut continues to write about her. About every decade or so, you'll find an article about like the resident cowgirl, you know, whether she was like kicking someone out of her bunkhouse barehanded or, you know, opening a riding school or whatever. People just really loved her as this kind of mascot for Americanness about what immigrants could do. Though again, it's important to note she was a Norwegian immigrant. And so she kind of had less of a barrier to that than a lot of women coming from even Southern Europe, let alone like Mexico or China or other places. So it's this interesting story about a woman who did this quite successfully within all of these debates about where women belonged in America and in the West.
It's super fascinating. And, you know, there's just, there's so many places we could go with that. But, you know, before you sort of loop back, you know, your second chapter is a little more disturbing, Right. Yeah. It's a little less fun, I guess one might say, the Texas prison rodeo. And I know enough about Texas prisons during this period to know they're not good places. And so would you talk about that, please?
Yeah. So the Texas prison rodeo runs ultimately for 50 years. And I kind of look at the whole stretch of it as a way to talk about how rodeo operated as a way to essentially advertise these abusive, I mean, they were plantation systems. They were rangeland labor. Incarcerated people were forced to work for free in appalling conditions. But the rodeo became a place where you could take that sort of violence of the prison system and weld it to this heroic story about rangeland labor and talk about how the kind of violence suffered by inmates, both on the plantations where they lived and then within the rodeo itself, was ultimately helping rehabilitate them. That this was a place where they could raise money. It was the only money. The entire Texas prison system had zero money for leisure or education for its entire incarcerated population. All of that money was raised once a year when hundreds of thousands of people attended this rodeo. And it was a way in which audience members, I mean, not only do you have that gladiatorial spectatorship where you're really ready to see somebody get injured, and the events allowed at the Texas prison rodeo were not allowed at mainstream rodeos. This was the exact time that the prison rodeo was being organized was the same time that what would become the PRCA, the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, was forming. And cowboys were creating a union to say, we will not perform under unsafe conditions or without pay. And so you have the Texas prison officials saying like, oh, well, free world cowboys won't do this, but our men will. And so they were doing mad scrambles where you have multiple bucking animals released into an arena at once. And you have that real desire to see people injured, but also that relationship to danger that the audience felt just being near incarcerated men. And it was very much about men. Women were not allowed to participate. They were finally in the 1970s allowed to do a couple of things that were incredibly demeaning, right? You couldn't ride a bronc, but you could ride a donkey. You could catch greased pigs, you know, these sorts of things for largely incarcerated women of color as a way to just add that level of sort of mockery. And I look at how, in a lot of ways, as incarcerated people themselves led the fight to improve their conditions of life within the system, the rodeo becomes more and more and more violent in a lot of ways as prison officials seek to, keep drawing and paying spectators. As interest starts to wane alongside sort of the bad economy of the 1970s, while also sort of proving that they can still exert control over at least some of those bodies. And it ultimately, you know, ends in the 1980s because they didn't have the money to rebuild the stadium, which I think is very interesting to think about. It's really the concern for the spectators and the fact that those were unsafe seating than any concern for the people who had been bloodied and bruised and maimed and injured in this arena over the decades.
Do we know anything about, you know, you mentioned the audience, you know, and I feel like it's probably a different sort of audience that's interested in Tilly Baldwin than is interested in the Texas prison rodeo. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but do you know sort of the ways that audiences are responding to one or both of these, you know, similar but really quite different scenarios?
Yeah. So I think one thing to think about is that, you know, Tilly Baldwin was performing both like in the rural West, right? There's lots of Idaho Statesman articles about her and performing at sort of local rodeos where, you know, at the time it was sort of seen as entertainment, right? Like these weren't your average ranch daughters out doing it. These were, you know, not actresses, but performers who are kind of brought in and they do these things. And so it is very much seen as kind of lighthearted entertainment when you can sort of rejoice in the Americana and the stories of the West. For what is promoted about Texas is, you know, we're already getting on into the 20th century. So even right in the 1930s, it is very much framed as nostalgia for the Old South. There are many sort of minstrel aspects in which, you know, some of the prison officials would gather up all, you know, Black men and have them and organize them into a glee club. And you have captions saying like a wonderful reminder of yesteryear. And you have exhibitions of dogs treeing inmates and references to treeing enslaved people. And so you have this kind of dynamic around a celebration of Texas as part of the Confederacy. And a lot of those spectators are coming from urban spaces, are coming from sort of a rapidly industrializing Houston to Huntsville. And so it's seen as a time to go reflect on your history that is increasingly far away. And it is still a family event, though. I think it's important to remember that, as we know, lots of horrific violence against people of color were family events. And so it is an interesting way. Now, one thing to note about the audience at the Texas Prison Rodeo is that there were people who that would be the only time they would get to see their child or their spouse or their sibling would be their performance at the rodeo. So there were sympathetic people in the audience who probably were not cheering to see them get hurt because it was their loved ones.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a little disturbing really, but you know, that's the story, I guess. Before I read your book, I happened to run across, not too long ago, and wrote about it for the website, the 1972 Jeff Canoe film Black Rodeo, about a Black rodeo in Harlem. And so certainly I was pretty excited to see the third chapter of your book about Black rodeo. And so, you know, that's a little bit more uplifting than prison rodeo. So why don't we switch to that for a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also important to remember that prison rodeo is really interesting because it's one of the only spaces in mid-century America where Black and white cowboys could rodeo together. There were segregated stands, but it was literally one of the only places that Black cowboys could be crowned champion over white cowboys. So that's, and all the, I sort of go into the implications of that in an incarcerated space. But Black rodeo, of course, is flourishing in the mid-century because in places like Texas and Oklahoma, so many places that were either former slave states or were places that, like Oklahoma, when it sort of switched from, you know, quote unquote Indian country, when essentially the U.S. government claimed all native land and made it available for settlement, many, many African-American people fled the South and the violence they were experiencing under the emergence of Jim Crow to Oklahoma. And so you have massive circuits of Black cowboys who are participating in hometown rodeos. Now, I try to tell the story of Black rodeo from the perspective of two places so that I could kind of dig into its meaning a little bit more. So I focused the first half of my chapter on Boley, Oklahoma, which was once the largest all-Black town in America. And I really look at the intersection of peoples that are arriving in Boley, because not only do you have, you know, sort of African-American immigrants coming from the South to Oklahoma, but you also have sort of well-established native Black families, many of whom had been enslaved by the Cherokee, the Choctaw, and others when they were sort of forced out of the American South to Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears. So you have, you know, Black Creeks living in Oklahoma as well. And so there's some tension, right, between sort of Native stories and Native identity and Black identity, and then these multiple forms of Black identity in Oklahoma, and how those are negotiated, but also with this increasing Jim Crow rhetoric gets flattened, and they're told, you know, if you're Black, you're Black. There isn't any room for these nuanced identities. And so I look at Bo Lee as a place that had so much hope. It was going to thrive at any moment. And that's really the rhetoric. And by the time, you know, you have the violence towards people in the 1910s and the 1920s, you have the Depression, you have the boll weevil. By the time we get to the 1960s, people feel pretty defeated. And Bo Lee, people have left. But they organize a rodeo as a way to talk about their heritage, as a way to talk about their belonging. And I look at that in the kind of context of civil rights and what does it mean to essentially talk about nation building and to say, like, we were there too, and how oftentimes you have people who really want to emphasize the history of Buffalo Soldiers and say, like, we helped return the Apache to the reservations. And we fought Native people too, when a lot of these people living in Bo Lee are the descendants of Black Creeks or Black Cherokee people and the Freemen. So you have this multi-layered issue of sort of demanding civil rights in the context of we helped build the nation. And then I sort of jump over to Oakland and talk about the Black Cowboy Parade that still happens, that was started in the 70s, that again is about sort of celebrating this Western heritage and people's place in it as a way to invest in civic pride, in education, in business, and is certainly invested in Black masculinity, even as it is often Black women who are doing the kind of labor that gets these big events, whether it's the Bo Lee Rodeo or the Oakland Parade, off the ground. But it is so important at the time, you know, as we think about other groups like the Black Panthers, it is very important to be emphasizing the kind of strength of Black men and how the cowboy helps play into that. And so I look at it as a way that is not precisely a radical break with America, right? It is not Black nationalism in a sort of separatist model. It's a way to say, we helped build America and therefore we belong in it.
What is the state of Black rodeo today?
I would say it's probably doing better today than ever. I mean, really, since the Black Lives Matter protests, the sort of profile of Black cowboys has skyrocketed. And we see all of the most innovative, I mean, this is probably true throughout the 20th century, that the most innovative sort of cowboy identity markers, whether it's fashion or music, are coming out of that Black rodeo circuit. So there is really great, I mean, I could spend all day on, like, the Yeehaw Agenda, where people are just demonstrating that kind of playfulness with the sort of cowboy icon that we don't always see on the mainstream rodeo circuit, particularly now when there's almost more pressure to conform to a very specific version of masculinity in these spaces.
I mean, I had sort of noticed surprising number of, say, Black men on horses, Black cowboy or, you know, regiments, if you will, in these recent protests. And so I was curious if that was, you know, if that was connected. So thank you for that. And then finally, you know, your last chapter, and I think maybe the one that is perhaps the most engaging of all of them is on gay rodeo. And so, you know, would you talk a little bit about that chapter?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously, cowboy culture has always been homosocial. Westerns have always included a lot of homoeroticism. There's a lot of focus on men being men with other men. What you have in the 1970s, and we see even sort of the emergence even earlier in the 1960s and maybe a little bit into the 1950s, well, you have a really productive overlap, right, between like sort of motorcycle leather and then brown leather cultures. And so the kind of post-war moment when men are coming back from the war, they're being told, like, use your GI Bill, get married, move into, you know, a Levitt town, produce in multiple ways for your country. There is a sort of subculture that emerges around, you know, motorcycles and BDSM, where you actually have a explicit rejection of the conflation between effeminacy and homosexuality. And you have these sort of hyper-masculine subcultures that are emerging in, you know, as I would say as early as the 1940s, but really into the 1960s and 1970s. And particularly with gay liberation, you have people sort of refusing to go back into the closet and to be quiet. And so what we have happened in the 1970s and 1980s is this kind of intersection between a broader cowboy chic that happens in the United States alongside the kind of rise of cowboy politics and the kind of investment and hardline masculinity and the emergence of things like gay rodeo. So it's important to realize that gay rodeo emerged out of the imperial court system, which is a competitive drag circuit that's really invested in supporting civic philanthropy. So essentially you would gain a title, emperor, empress, and then you would raise money for your local community. And one of these people, Phil Ragsdale in Reno, he was the first emperor of Reno, and he decided, well, wouldn't it be fun to put on kind of a gay rodeo and see if we can earn some money? And it was very hard the first year. Obviously, people don't want to rent stock. They don't want to rent rodeo grounds, those sorts of things. But they were able to host it. They made a couple $100. And it started this whole sort of movement. And for about 10 years in Reno, they hosted rodeos. And Reno's in a really great spot because they could draw from California and all over. Texas started sending contingents. And often these groups are organized around bars. So Charlie's Bar, for instance, in Denver, would send like a whole busload of gay men and women to compete at the Reno Rodeo. Now, other places like Colorado got interested in hosting their own. And so they eventually created the International Gay Rodeo Association in 1985. And I sort of look at it in this context in terms of its promotional materials, how the association framed itself, which was deeply, deeply masculinist. Gay women are a part of this. Lesbians are a part of it, but they are definitely not always present in the advertising materials, in the kind of rhetoric surrounding it. And you really do actually have some people in the association explicitly rejecting effeminate gay men, lesbians, drag queens, anyone who they feel like is not upholding the kind of hyper masculine cowboy that they emulate. And of course, this is also coinciding with kind of the heyday. You know, all of these people had grown up on Western films, on Western television. You know, it was just the epitome of masculinity. And so you have a whole group of gay rodeoers who grew up in cities, but grew up on these stories and wanted to be that. And then you also have a group of people who grew up in the rural West, who wanted to rodeo, but couldn't. They didn't feel safe. And they sort of fled to cities. They fled to, you know, to anonymity, but also could never fit in those metropolitan spaces. They always felt like they didn't quite fit because they wanted to listen to country music or line dance or two-step or wear boots. And that wasn't really what that community was telling them to do. So you have gay rodeo that becomes kind of a hub of, you know, gay country western bars and cloggers and line dancers and people who are interested in lots of different equestrian events. You know, they're in the Quarter Horse Association and they do dressage and other types of horse events. And then people who really just sort of embraced that aesthetic of well, you know, like beer and boots and not kind of the club scene. And I try to really focus in on what that does for the kind of gendered aspects, who gets to belong, where are the debates, and IGRA especially has always had a push and pull of wanting to be inclusive and not always being able to live up to that. Yeah.
So one last question for you before we let you go, which is, you know, that the issue of gay rodeo has come to, I think, be a big part of your scholarly identity. And so could you talk a little bit about some of the other projects around gay rodeo that you are leading at this time?
Yeah. So as part of my research, you know, I started my book project as my dissertation in the American Studies program at Harvard, and I was very far away from the West. So it was very hard to travel to rodeos. So as soon as I got my job, I was actually able to get a seed grant from my university to start an oral history aspect of my book project. Partly going into the archives as a historian, you know, you don't always work on living populations. And so I had gone into the archive, I had some ideas, but I kind of wanted to see whether people who had lived through it agreed with those ideas or not. And I really saw the passion people had for this association. And we're, you know, going on 40 years, a lot of those founders, obviously we lost a lot of people with the AIDS epidemic. But then also, you know, we're just getting to a point where some of those founders are in their 80s. So I thought this was a very important thing to pursue. And so my, you know, I was able to collect about 36 on my first round of interviews that range from a couple minutes to like full 2-hour oral histories. And then I was able to get another grant and we were supposed to go to many rodeos in 2020. We were not able to do that. But we are actually up to 65 interviews at this point with the Gay Rodeo Oral History Project. Many of those we've curated into an exhibit called The Voices of Gay Rodeo. And then also from that, I'm collaborating with some MFA students and the chair of the theater department here, Rob Casely, to create a verbatim theater piece in which we use the words of actual rodeoers to sort of tell the story of this association. And we've done one reading thus far, and it was very successful and kind of allowed us to come back, and we'll be continuing to revise that script. I'm also co-authoring a book tentatively titled Slapping Leather, Sport and Performance at the Gay Rodeo with a colleague, Dr. Alyssa Ford, who's also written a book on rodeo. And we thought we could bring together all of our decades of research on this topic because it is a really rich subject. It brings together so much, so many themes in LGBTQ history and how people, we've sort of focused scholarship a lot on the liberation movements that were occurring in urban spaces, but often don't tell these really complex stories about people who felt cut off in those places.
Yeah, no, thank you. And for listeners, I will put a link to the Voices of Gay Rodeo web exhibit on the website. So definitely check that link out. I was messing around with it before our interview here, and it was really awesome. It was really one of my favorite things on the internet right now. So thank you so much for that. And Rebecca, again, you know, thank you again. for everything. I should, I guess, say to our listeners again that we've been talking to Rebecca Schofield at the University of Idaho about her book, Outriders, Rodeo at the Fringes of the America West. You can get that at the University of Washington Press website or whatever online book depository you like, or maybe in some bookstores in the American West. One could certainly hope so. So thank you again, Rebecca.
Thank you.
All right. And we will see you all next time.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,